off again tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, November 5th. Cloudy and breezy, seasonal temperatures, and a 70% chance of rain later this afternoon, a high today 50. Right now, breezy indeed, wind from the southwest at 15, 45 degrees in Racine, 44 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Burr. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with a best-selling author by the name of Andrew Gross, and it's very likely that you are already acquainted with some of the books that he has already written, including Reckless, Eyes Wide Open, The Saboteur, The Dark Tide, Don't Look Twice, 1 Mile Under. His latest book is so intriguing, and it is called Button Man. And there are ways in which this this beautifully crafted novel spring very much out of Andrew Gross's own family background, at least to some extent. It takes us back to the early 20th century and to a particular neighborhood in New York City on the Lower East Side, and to several different brothers who in one way or another are part of the garment industry at that point in time. So we're roughly set between the years 1905 and 1935. And this is something of a family saga with richly drawn characters and also set against the backdrop of a very turbulent and often difficult period in New York City's history. And so I'm very excited to be able to speak with Andrew Gross about this beautifully crafted book, which is published by Minotaur Books. Andrew Gross, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Nice to be here.
I know that this novel, to some extent, is inspired by a very special person and someone whose life, in many respects, is a very direct inspiration. That man was your grandfather. Tell our listeners about your grandfather and the most significant facets of who he was and the life he lived that are a very direct inspiration for Button Man.
Sure. You know, between the years 1880 and 1910, over 20 million immigrants came to this country. And the book that I've written, Button Man, is the story of one of them. My grandfather was someone who never went, grew up on the streets of the Lower East Side, which we can talk about was the most densely populated area in the world, including Calcutta, and riddled with crime and poverty. And he had to quit school at 12, like a lot of, you know, young Jews who had just come here. He never got past the fifth grade, went to work as an apprentice in a garment factory, and by the time he was 19, was running that factory and the entire business around it. At some point, he formed his own company and had to go head-to-head against the Jewish mob who had taken over the garment unions for their illicit gain. And even to the day he died, he would proudly lift his shirt and show the two stab wounds in his abdomen that were courtesy of Louis Lepke, who was the most feared bloody killer in New York at that point, and ultimately built up his fledgling company into an iconic national brand. Some of your readers, some of your listeners, pardon me, might remember a firm called Leslie Fay, but at some point it was on the New York Stock Exchange, so it grew into a big diversified company. And so he had one of these lives that started with nothing and ended up with quite a bit. And so I put this story against the backdrop of a 30-year sweeping tale. It is a thriller. I mean, I'm a thriller writer. I'm paid to write thrillers by St. Martin's and Minotaur. But it's also a boy to manhood story in a period piece that deals with two sort of interesting things that very few people write about. One is the formation of the garment business in New York, which people see today as this big sort of glossy fashion business. There were two ways out for Jews on the Lower East Side. One was the clothing business that had no barriers to entry, and the other was crime. And so this story really sort of builds on those two facets. I call it Great Expectations meets The Godfather, because it is the story of a young boy like Pip, who grows into not quite a gentleman per se, but an adult and a successful one against this class struggle. And The Godfather, of course, because of its depiction of organized crime and its uniquely cultural aspect, you know, they're the Italian mob, and in my book, the Jewish mob.
I assume you knew your grandfather. I mean, I gathered that from the acknowledgments. I want to be sure that you tell our listeners about something that quite extraordinary that occurred when you visited the library of the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. And your words, they gave you an extraordinary gift that you were not expecting.
Yeah, I, you know, in doing research for this book, when I first decided to do it, I went to FIT, you know, which is, I don't know what your listeners know, but it's a big prominent school devoted to the fashion and retail business in New York City. And, you know, has, I think, 10 or 12 buildings and on the campus. And I went to the head archivist there trying to get information about the early years of the business. And, you know, the first thing she did was hook me up on microfilm with old issues of Women's Wear Daily dating back to the 20s. And interestingly, I found my grandfather's name. He wouldn't have been more than 20 years old, but there he was popping up all over the place as kind of, you know, an important, we call them machers, and well, in Yiddish would be like, you know, an important person even at that ridiculously young age. And then, you know, a bunch of old sort of dog-eared, you know, worn books that no one had ever taken out in decades. And then, as you say, she gave me something that I will never forget. And she told me many of the founding fathers of this industry gave their oral testimonies on tape for the permanent archives here. Would you like to hear your grandfather's? And that was how, 30 years after he died, I got to hear his voice all over again on 2.5 hours of tape, going over the stories that I knew, you know, growing up. I certainly had heard from him, you know, many, many times, but hearing it now in his own gravelly voice, you know, in his own sort of street-hewn way of talking, because he never had much education. Interestingly, before he died, his name was on the buildings in four college campuses. So, you know, he, I guess, did his best to make up for a lack of education. But there I was listening to him as if he had never died, as if he had just gone away a few years, and now he was back. So it was a very emotional experience for me. I have to admit, I sort of wept through a lot of it. And, you know, of course, have shared it prominently in the family, and even more so now have shared it in this book with everyone.
You call this his story with only a few embellishments, that his story, meaning your grandfather's story, with only a few embellishments. Can you give us a little clearer idea of just what the balance is here between, in a sense, fact and fiction, the historical record as you understand it, versus whatever had to be added to the story to leaven it, to give it the texture that was appropriate for this kind of a book?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, for your readers who might remember Doctorow's book Ragtime, where historical figures sort of laced seamlessly in with fictional figures, this book is very much like that. Prominent characters in this book are mobsters like Louis Lepke, who is the principal adversary, who the main character grew up with as a kid on the streets, and has this sort of really interesting respect hatred relationship with. They both respect each other because the main character Morris, based after my grandfather, stood up to him. So, I mean, you know, because my grandfather lived kind of a rich life, I didn't have to embellish too much. But I'm a thriller writer, and obviously, when you do that, you have to perhaps stretch the stories a little bit. The scenes are mine. I mean, I wasn't there. Nobody was really there. The scenes are all mine. It reads like a novel, but at the same time, many of the figures in the book are real. So we have, like I mentioned, Lepke, Dutch Schultz, the famous mobster, Jewish mobster, is a prominent figure in the book. Also is Thomas Dewey, who was the appointed special prosecutor, who was Javert-like in single-mindedly trying to put Lepke and Dutch Schultz away behind bars for good. He ended up running for governor and ended up running for president at some point. Like I said, my grandfather's life was rich enough. He was attacked by the mob. He did stand up to the mob. So that, you know, as a novelist, I mean, of course, you're going to take some liberties with it. But the central truth is what it was like to be there at that time. And the history, both of the garment business and the Jewish mob. It's worth mentioning, I think, Greg, that back in the 20s and 30s, the Jewish mob was far bloodier than the Italian mob was. Not a lot of people, I guess, know this, unless, you know, you had a particular interest in it. But the Italian mob used to farm out its hits to the Jewish mob, who turned it into a murder-for-hire business, hence the name Murder Incorporated, which was the most feared, you know, underworld, organization for years and years and years. People might remember names like Arnold Rothstein, who fixed the 1919 World Series, who was famous, and Bugsy Siegel, who started, Las Vegas, and Dutch Schultz, who is this sort of irascible, unpredictable guy who had 100 murders on his own resume, who actually started the numbers business in New York. They were larger than life, sort of big time figures, and they were the most prominent mobsters of their time.
We're speaking with Andrew Gross about his newest novel called Button Man, something of a historical novel and also a thriller set in New York City in the early 20th century in the garment industry. And it follows especially Morris Rabashevsky and his two brothers, Sol and Harry, as well. Morris Rabashevsky is certainly the main character and based to some extent upon the author's grandfather. One of the things...
Can I talk a moment?
Yes.
I mean, would you mind if I talked a moment about these three brothers?
Sure.
I haven't mentioned them, and it's kind of the heart of the book.
Of course.
There are these three Rabashevsky brothers. One of them is Saul, the oldest, who is, steady and level-headed and who had to drop out of accounting school when his father died. The other was Morris, who's the hero of the book, who's, you know, tall and powerful and has you know, is comfortable using his fists and often does to solve matters, and has this incredible drive and unshakable moral center to him that really provides, you know, the heroic aspect of the book. And the third brother is Harry. And the book begins with a family tragedy that Harry, as a child, feels he's responsible for his whole life, that allows him, even though he's kind of a nice guy, affable guy, to get seduced into a life of crime. So you have one brother who sort of has who sides with these criminals, even though he's not a violent person himself, and the other two who become the targets of the criminals. So it both binds the brothers at some point, separates the brothers. There's betrayal, there is redemption, and my sort of favorite emotion, forgiveness. So you know, the relationship between the three brothers guides the book and really runs the gauntlet of you know, the emotional dynamics of any family.
Right, absolutely. And they're very richly drawn, compelling, and authentic. One of the things I especially enjoyed was the story relatively early in the novel of Morris's rise through the garment factory where he is working. And of course, that would be a very distinctive story. I mean, most of the time, someone would not manage any rise really whatsoever through the ranks, or certainly not the way Morris did. But he is bright and determined and has some chutzpah and really manages right to do it. Can you just share with our listeners what I'm talking about? I'm thinking in particular of of when someone had to step aside from a post they'd had a long time, and Morris is able to offer himself up as someone to step into that spot.
Mr. Beck.
Yes.
You know, he starts out as basically a child in this factory, and his boss says, "You want to learn? Just keep your eyes open." And Morris keeps his eyes open. And at some point, this you know, European tailor who's their marker maker. I don't know if people know what markers are, but they still kind of exist. But of course, now they're all computer driven. But in the days going back, even when I was in the business, there were these really talented marker makers who would sit on these, you know, and draw out, you know, fit the pattern pieces, you know, into a configuration where it could be cut that would maximize the yield on fabric. And this was a real art, because it was where you made and lost your money was in the consumption of fabric. So this old guy, Mr. Berg, finally has to quit. He's just too old and he's sick, and they're scrambling to try to figure out how to find someone. And here's, I think it's 15-year-old Morris who knocks on the door of the factory owner and says, "I can do the job." And of course, everybody laughs at him. "You're 15 years old." But he proves to them the next day that he can do the job and do it well. And it's really just one of these great scenes of you know, there is kind of cantankerous boss who owns the place, who just thinks that this you know, kid shows such impetuousness and he should probably fire him for insubordination. And instead, he suddenly realizes that he's got this gifted pattern maker, this gifted marker maker there. And then he says, "All right, you know, I'll give you a try." And then, of course, Morris, in typical chutzpah, says, "There's a raise that goes with it, no?" And he goes, "A raise? You're lucky I gave you a job. You're so impertinent." And he says, you know, I don't remember the exact number. It's in my own book. But, you know, he basically, like, quadruples his salary. And everyone says, "What, are you crazy?" And the guy's wife, the owner's wife, says, "You know, if we had to go find this guy in the open market, we'd pay twice as much." So, you know, that's how Morris sort of got his first opportunity. And it's also, you know, he quadrupled his pay.
Hmm. I also appreciate how well you have drawn the character of Harry Rabashevsky, who is the brother, as you've already said, who ends up kind of falling in with the mob. And I think you really help us understand how such a thing could be possible, and how someone to fall into that life does not need to be evil or violence. Or of shallow character, and sometimes even personal characteristics that might in some ways or in some circumstances be very positive can also be the very things that in a sense lead you down such a path. Can you tell us more about what you thought about as you crafted the figure of Harry Rabashevsky? And is he patterned on somebody in your own life or in your own family's life?
Not really anyone in my life. I've always written thrillers, and I've really kind of liked, you know, Harry is not a bad guy, although he does things that, that enable the mob to have a big advantage over his family. But he's really a person who seeks self-esteem. And like I mentioned, he, without giving it away, something takes place in the first chapter that has a permanent scar on the family. He feels responsible. And because of that, he's seeking his whole life for this self-esteem that never comes from how he lives his life in the straight world, but to his mind comes from his association with these, you know, colorful mobsters. And of course, the colorful mobsters go from, you know, knocking a few heads around and maybe doing a robbery to becoming murderers. And he's still, you know, under their wing to some extent. And then, without giving it away as well, deeper into the book, ends up being an unwitting accomplice to a very prominent, bad thing that takes place. And now, all of a sudden, he's stepped into, the real world of crime and, unfortunately, tragically, its consequences. So it just sort of shows the little incrementality of character that one step at a time, and then suddenly he's on the side of the wrong people, you know. And that's kind of the way that I've always crafted my bad guys. Even Louis Lepke, who is, I guess, the prominent, bad guy antagonist in this book, is someone in many ways I think you'd like, even though he's a impetuous, you know, violent sort of character. He's got enough charisma and somewhere in his heart humanity that you don't just look at him as an evil guy. You look at him as a real flesh and blood person. His way out of the neighborhood was crime. And when you get involved in crime, it advances into more violent things. Morris's way out of the neighborhood was in garments. So they both took these divergent paths and ended up in a confrontation later in life that, is the central conflict of the book.
Incredible. Do you have time for one more question?
Yes, sir.
I especially enjoyed the way in which you plotted out and presented to us the budding romance between Morris and a lovely young woman by the name of Ruthie, who is from a very, very different background. Just tell our listeners a little bit about the interesting dynamic between them and, in a sense, what an uncommon relationship this would have been at this point in time for two people from two very different places to come together the way that they did.
Which is often pointed out to Morris that we come from different worlds. This one was kind of based in truth. My grandfather ended up marrying a prominent flapper of the day, who college educated from a well-to-do family, lived on the Upper West Side, which was everyone's dream on the Lower East Side, was to get to the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side, perhaps. But they in life should never have been together. And in truth of fact, they ended up spending 60, you know, argumentative years together. But the fact is that Morris was someone who went after what he shouldn't really, because to him everything was attainable. And so he woos this flapper and eventually, you know, gets her. But there's a lot of resistance. There's a lot of sense that someone who had no education, someone who sort of talked with marbles in his mouth, really had no chance at this gal, but eventually he wears her down. And there's actually a great scene, Greg, is at least for me, where, you know, she's the one who brings up the book Great Expectations. And because she says that he reminds her of Pip. And he decides to go read the book. And he goes into a bookstore for the first time in his life. And he starts looking around the racks, and he doesn't see Great Expectation anywhere. And he's almost about to leave. And the store personnel comes over and sort of says, "Oh, of course we have it, but you're in the history section, sir. It's in literature." And he doesn't even know enough to realize that he was, you know, in a completely different section. But, you know, reads the book and eventually makes the comment that the difference between Pip and he is that Pip had a benefactor in Miss Havisham, and he, if he had a benefactor, it was himself. And so he sort of says, "I ain't no Pip." But it really, you know, their relationship, as you mentioned, is one of the, there's some passion in it too, but it's definitely, I always like secondary and tertiary characters. I think I've always in my books had a skill at not just sort of building around the hero, but populating it with all of these different characters. And, you know, there's in this book, there's his friend, Morris's friend, Irv, who is his childhood friend, who he's engaged with for much of the book, who ends up playing a very pivotal role as well. So, you know, I love giving life to these secondary and tertiary characters that, to me, give so much resonance, to a book. So it's not just about a hero or a bad guy.
Absolutely. I think that gives the book great texture, and I'm glad that this story and many others, many other plot lines like it are part of this novel. There is also, of course, woven through so much of this novel, a backdrop of this ominous threat of the mob, and this real sense of terrible danger lurking right around the corner. And I wonder if you could just say a word about the tools at your disposal to help generate that kind of sense of fear, for even for us as the readers, reading this from the safety of our easy chair, decades after these events, you know, would have occurred. I was really struck by your exceptional ability, in a sense, to scare the reader, or at least fill us with a real sense of dread for what might befall these characters. How does a writer do that?
How does a writer do that? I guess that's the sort of undeterminable skill that you bring to your craft. I mean, I'm a thriller writer, and about three books ago, I made a turn in my career and started writing thrillers that were historically based, and wrote two in World War II. There's one book I have to plug. You managed to skip over it, but I can't, only because it ended up being my biggest book in my career, and I've had, you know, 11 bestsellers, and that's called The One Man.
Oh, yes.
Which took place in a lot of it in Auschwitz, and was a Holocaust sort of driven book, but it's still a thriller. So, you know, I cut my bones, I guess, writing thrillers. I did originally work with Jim Patterson on six books. So it's just something I know how to do. And how do you do it? You humanize people, and then you put people in a situation where they have to make a moral choice. And that, to me, is what's fascinating. And Morris's moral choice is that he chooses to, even against his own code, that he's not a rat, that he, you know, he's not a bad guy, but that he doesn't sort of, you know, want to wear a wire or anything like that. But he stands up to these people when no one else will, and eventually, because it's a matter of historical record, breaks this really, you know, violent gang. I mean, in real life, my grandfather did not do that, but as I mentioned, he was stabbed by them. So, you know, he was in, he did stand up. And just quickly, I guess, to give your listeners a sense of it, you know, the mob not only controlled the unions, where they took their dues and put them in their pocket, and we're talking millions of dollars back then, because the garment business in the 20s and 30s was the second largest business in New York. but they also took over the chains of supply and the trim and the button companies. And by the way, I don't know if your readers know, I didn't say it, but Button Man isn't just about garments. Button Man, back in the day, was slang for a mafia hitman, so it has that double meaning.
Mm.
But these guys were bad, and originally, if you stood up to them as a businessman, you might get them to come up and throw a stink bomb in your warehouse. Well, it sounds sort of, you know, benign, but a stink bomb would destroy all of your inventory and could put you out of business. The second chapter of the book is someone who gets acid thrown in their face because he resists them and tries to go around them. And then there's also a character who ends up being hurled out of a 14-story window. So, you know, their methods were pretty harsh, and they had no compunction about killing and or maiming or defacing or destroying. So, you know, that was the world then.
Wow. And populating it, some very, very compelling characters, including one, Morris Rabashevsky, the heart and soul of this wonderful novel, again called Button Man, published by Minotaur Press, the author, Andrew Gross. Andrew Gross, it's great to catch up with you and great to speak with you about your marvelous new novel. Thank you so much and best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's morning show is a favorite interview from the archives. I like nothing more than to be introduced to an important person about whom I've never heard a word. And that's really the case with the New York Times bestseller, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, which introduces us to the very important figure of Thomas Dent Mütter, a very important doctor and surgeon from the 19th century, who, as much as anyone, helped to revolutionize the way that medicine was practiced, and especially the way in which surgery was practiced. And he was a gifted and in some ways incredibly flamboyant man, and he had a wonderful way with words. And so what he said about the profession of medicine is absolutely captivating, as is this book about him, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine, written by the award-winning author Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. And she is born and raised in Philadelphia, where much of the story of Dr. Thomas Dent Mütter unfolds. And he is still very well-known in the city of Philadelphia, not as well-known as he should be, given his importance. And so I am so happy to have had the opportunity to read this endlessly fascinating book, and now I have a few precious minutes to speak with the author, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, about this book published by Avery, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really happy to be here.
And I'm happy to be talking to someone who lives in Philadelphia, where I happen to have a brother who lives. And was I overstating it when I said that the city of Philadelphia well knows the name of Thomas Dent Mütter better than the rest of us do?
Absolutely. It is the home of the Mütter Museum, which is a museum of 19th century medical oddities. And so if you grew up in Philly, this was a place you went to a lot on field trips and school trips, and it just became a part of the culture of being a kid and growing up in Philly. And it wasn't until I left Philly that I realized there was anything unusual about it, and that not every kid grows up with a medical oddity science museum in their childhood. And that's how I first became interested in learning more about the man who founded it.
Absolutely.
Of which little was known.
And I want us to talk about that. I want to give you maybe 40 seconds to just list a couple of the really interesting things that are found at that museum. I mean, I think it's important for people to appreciate that.
Absolutely. Exactly. Well, there's Madame Dimanche. She's a woman who had a horn that started growing from the center of her forehead. She's actually from Dr. Mutter's original collection. We have the death cast and conjoined liver of Chang and Ang, the famous sideshow act, the conjoined twins, which gave us the term Siamese twins. They have a 9-foot megacolon that was extracted from a human being who is known as the human balloon. The megacolon is so popular that they actually sell a plushy version of the megacolon in their gift store, so you could take it home with you. You have the Hurdle Skull Collection, which is skulls collected from all over the world to disprove the concept of phrenology, the idea that you can tell people's character through ridges on their skulls. You have, you know, limbs in jars. The thing I couldn't handle was the wall of eye trauma, essentially a wall of eyeballs of which awful things have all happened to them and how we would treat such a thing. It's a pretty, I wouldn't suggest, you know, I've had now 2 book release parties at the museum, and I always say I save a lot on catering because no one wants to eat after visiting the museum.
Right. Of course, the thing that's interesting is that museum, it brings his name to the public, but in a sense it doesn't necessarily help us understand just how important he was and what a revolutionary figure he was. Explain how the state of medicine was in such a state that Dr. Mutter found it so deeply objectionable. I think most of us don't know enough about early medicine before it really began to enjoy scientific rigor.
Exactly. I mean, even the tools. I mean, that's one of the things I must have thought was so frustrating, is to have an innate instinct towards things like germ theory, right? The idea that diseases can be, and infections can be spread through, you know, contact with an infected surface, whether that's a hand or a tool. That was not proven, really, until the invention of the modern microscope in the late 1800s. Mutter died in 1859. So he, you know, his belief that you should wash your hands and tools prior to surgery was seen as a feat and weak. You know, one of his colleagues at the university he taught at, Miggs, with whom he clashed a lot with, used to be offended at the idea that doctors would wash their hands prior to seeing patients because, quote, it insisted that doctors were not gentlemen because all gentlemen were clean men. So the idea that doctors were actually taking stances against washing your hands and tools gives you a clue of what 19th century was like. They didn't have electric lighting, so all surgeries were done by candlelight or sunlight. They didn't have ether anesthesia. All surgery patients were awake during their procedures, and in fact, a part of the service was men would be paid to hold you down on the surgical table, both to keep you still during the surgery, but also to prevent you from running away. You did not need a license to practice medicine. You did not need a degree to practice medicine. You literally could just say you were a doctor, hang a shingle outside of your house, and begin putting leeches on people. It was a real wild, wild west. And during Mutter's lifetime, you know, the changes that made for what we know and enjoy as modern medicine today began to fall into place. And Mutter himself was at the forefront of it. You know, he really viewed medicine and practiced medicine in a way that I think today we would all love to be treated. And this was, you know, decades before some of his theories would be proven. So he was really forward thinking and, you know, a great hero in my mind.
You connect him to the city of Paris, France, in several different ways.
Yes.
How important was that in terms of shaping the kind of doctor that he was? I mean, living and working in Paris, was that an important contributing factor in the groundbreaking work which he did?
Absolutely. You know, back in the 19th century, you know, if you were going to study medicine, you could not really be an exceptional doctor, you know, one who worked in the highest stratas, unless you were already born into a wealthy class, because wealthy people would only trust you know, other wealthy people at that time period. You wouldn't take someone whose background you didn't know to examine your wife. You know, that was just seen as completely implausible. The only field in which you could really come from the background that Mutter did, Mutter was a poor orphan, and succeed and make a name for yourself was surgery, because it was something where skill would outweigh any other factor. You know, if you were going to have your leg cut off and you were awake during the surgery, you kind of didn't care if that guy knew your dad. You know, what you cared about was, would it be done cleanly, as with as least pain as possible, and would you survive the surgery? In order to be the best surgeon possible, Mutter, you know, kind of tricked his way over to Paris to study with the best surgery being done in the world at that time period, and came across the field of study which he would become known for, which over there was called operations plastique, and what today we would know as plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery. And this was an area of surgery that was brand new to you know, modern medicine. Obviously, if you were having surgeries done on you while you were awake, you would only want that to happen if it was a life or death situation, essentially elective surgery, right? Wanting to help fix a deformity or disfigurement by choice was not something a lot of people made, unless they were certain that that the outcome would, you know, would be would make their life better and happier, and that they would survive the surgery. And Mutter saw plastic surgery for the first time in Paris and knew immediately that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to come back to America and reach out to these populations of patients that were completely underserved. I mean, the severely deformed back then were literally categorized medically as monsters. That was a medical term, in the way that idiot was a medical term. And he saw these people as human beings. You know, he was very sick throughout his entire life, and especially through his childhood, and he knew what it was like to be a patient and knew what it was like to not be treated well by the doctors who were tasked with healing you, and he knew that this was a population that did not get the respect it deserved.
Right.
So he went in back to America and did revolutionary work. The surgeries that he did and invented were so forward-thinking that there's some of them are still being used today.
We should mention that early in his life, he actually received some very good care from physicians. I think it was something where they were at sort of spelling out very clearly what his future was likely to be physically, and he so appreciated the care he received that that's one of the things that inspired him to pursue a medical profession.
Absolutely. That sort of clarity and transparency was not a part of 19th century medicine. People rarely sought the help of doctors and only in extreme situations. And doctors, you know, again, if you're performing work on a patient without any sort of painkiller or anesthetic, it's going to be excruciating for that person. And you're just going to have to ignore their screams and cries to get the work done that you know needs to be done. So there was a big gulf between patient and doctor. And doctors were sort of trained to sort of ignore their patients. And Mutter just took a stride against it. And you could see that in the work that he did. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, most apparent metaphor is he was the inventor of what we know to be the modern recovery room. You know, prior to that, if you had surgeries done in a surgical clinic, they just put you in sort of an unwashed wagon and rode you home over the cobblestone streets of Philadelphia. Mutter was appalled by this. You know, he was doing these very delicate surgeries, and he didn't want infection to set in. He didn't want the stitches to be disrupted by rattling in a wagon, and he insisted that the college that he taught at, Jefferson Medical College, build recovery rooms, and they refused. They just did not see the reason for it, and Mutter was so adamant that this be done that he himself used his own money to rent a floor above a restaurant and would move his patients into that floor and watch over them along with the help of his students. To that today, that seems like common sense. Of course you would do that, but back then it was just unheard of. So that's an example of the humanist philosophies that Mutter put into practice that really put the patient and the patient's care front and center instead of the infallible, you know, dictations of the doctor, which was definitely the way 19th century medicine, you know, moved.
It's especially fascinating in your book to read about the battle over anesthesia and the fact that and Dr. Mutter did not invent anesthesia, but he was one of its most persuasive champions. And your book outlines the reservations that most other doctors had about anesthesia, in particular the fact that some doctors relied on the on what the patient would tell them through the course of the surgery, and the idea that of of the patient being out cold during the surgery, how are we going to talk to them then? but for other reasons too, some of them just could not open themselves up to this notion.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to read of Dr. Mutter's tenacious insistence that this was the only humane way to do surgery.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking, you know, and researching Dr. Mutter's marvels, you know, I'd always thought that scientific progress was sort of, you know, a march up a mountain, you know, innovation building upon innovation. And when you would have something like, ether anesthesia surgery being, you know, essentially invented, that doctors would flock to it. Oh, my God, this is clearly the next thing. To realize that there was a battle against it, that hospitals banned it, was shocking to me. But again, when you view it through the lens of the 19th century, it began to make more sense. You know, one of the reasons you spoke about was that doctors throughout time had performed surgeries on and learned from their patients who were awake during the surgeries. So if you were talking to a patient and he began to sort of fade away and you realize, oh, this patient is at risk of bleeding out, and if I don't stop the surgery now, they're going to die on my table. If the patient is already unconscious, how would you ever get that information before you had the medical tools that we have today? Another reason was because of the lack of standardized medicine. You know, it's another thing I always took for granted of. I don't expect the Tylenol I buy in New York City to be different than the Tylenol I buy in Chicago. But back then, you know, your jar of ether could have varying strength depending on who made it or where it was made or when it was made. So the surgeries themselves were with a very unstable chemical. And the last one was sort of the most surprising to me, which was before germ theory was really proven, doctors did not wash their hands and tools, and the death rates of people who had surgery under ether versus surgery while they were awake were pretty much exactly the same, which is shocking. You would think that a thrashing person on the table would cause a lot more deaths than someone who was calmly knocked out. But it was the infections after the surgeries that were the real killers of 19th century medicine.
And it didn't matter how the surgery was done, in a sense. I mean,
right. Exactly. And so it was really the doctor's choice. If the doctor says, you know, it doesn't seem to affect their death rates, they die at the same rate whether or not they're knocked out enough, and I don't trust this chemical, and I've done surgeries with people awake the whole time, it's my choice whether or not I want to do this, then it kind of makes sense. But of course, as a patient, you would think you would choose to be knocked out every time. Unfortunately, at that time in medicine, we were not given the option of whether or not we would want that service. But, you know, those sorts of things just made researching Dr. Mutter's marvels such a pleasure. You know, I really, you know, fell in love with that time period and the debates and the, you know, discoveries that were happening. Everything was so new, and you have people like Mutter who had a vision. You know, Mutter was fastidiously clean. He knew innately, and perhaps from being a patient himself, the difference between a clean doctor and a dirty doctor, and knew that being clean, fastidiously so, is going to help your patient in the long run. But his theories on this wouldn't be proven for 50 years after his death. You know, it's incredible what he was forced to endure for things that would later be, you know, proven with a microscope or proven with an X-ray.
A man truly ahead of his time who made life better for so many people.
Yes.
And your book tells the story so brilliantly. The book, again, is Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a New York Times bestseller, now available in paperback. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, its author. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, congratulations on an absolutely spectacular book. I loved every page. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The time is exactly 8:58 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be playing for you the interview that I recorded with the author of a really special book called Never in Finer Company. The book explores a dramatic chapter from the First World War and the very, very courageous Allied soldiers who were part of one of the most important crucial battles. Those men were known as the Lost Battalion because for a time these soldiers were completely cut off from all lines of support, and their courage under fire was really, truly remarkable. So I'll be speaking with the author of this new book about these men. On Wednesday, we will be talking politics the morning after this big midterm election with Jeff Roberg and Jerry Mast from the political science faculty at Carthage College. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.